This recording accompanies the Language B Higher Level Examination, Paper 2, Listening Comprehension, for English, November 2024.
Cet enregistrement accompagne l'examen de Langue B, Niveau supérieur, Épreuve 2, Compréhension orale d'anglais, novembre 2024.
Esta grabación acompaña el examen de lengua B, nivel superior, prueba 2, comprensión auditiva, de inglés, noviembre 2024.
The start and end of each audio text will be indicated by this sound.
Le début et la fin de chaque texte audio seront indiqués par ce son.
El inicio y el final de cada texto de audio se indicarán con este sonido.
The end of the examination will be indicated by this sound.
La fin de l'examen sera indiquée par ce son.
El final del examen se indicará con este sonido.
Text A. You now have 4 minutes to read the questions.
You are going to hear a conversation between a salesperson and a customer about buying a phone.
Okay, who is my next customer?
Oh, that's me. I'm looking for a phone.
What are you in the market for? We mainly carry refurbished goods, but we also have new devices.
Well, before buying my current phone, I read that refurbished phones were as good as new ones, but I'm not sure I agree now.
In my opinion, they're often as good as new. Of course, other factors can also affect the quality, like whether it's certified or how it's been maintained. However, refurbished phones are a lot less expensive than a new device.
Well, I bought this phone refurbished to save money, as you said. But now I plan to buy a new phone because I think it will last longer.
That's not been my experience, but new phones have other advantages. However, if you are buying a new phone, we'd like to encourage you to recycle your old phone because technology products create e-waste.
E-waste? What's that?
Electronic waste. It's now one of the most talked about environmental issues worldwide. Any discarded electrical item can be considered e-waste. But here, we focus on technology and devices.
So, do you recycle devices here?
Not here at the shop. We lack the equipment. But we do collect devices for recycling, for a small fee. It's not cheap to recycle devices, so we cover our costs as we all feel it's essential to protect the environment.
That's okay. It's important that we all do our part.
Great. Let's look at some phones over here then.
You know, I've never really thought about e-waste before.
Believe it or not, there are more mobile phones than people on the planet.
Really?
Look at this diagram on the wall. This is the waste hierarchy, which ranks the preferred order for 5 actions to manage waste, including e-waste. At the top, the most environmentally friendly option is prevention. This means that there's less creation of waste. If people use items longer, for example, fewer phones would need to be manufactured. Reduction is the next best option, followed by recycling. Then, recovery of waste is the fourth stage before disposal, which means that items end up in a landfill. That's the worst option for the environment.
So recycling is important then?
Yes. Unfortunately, only 15 to 20% of e-waste is recycled. And tech products are made with precious metals and minerals. When these end up in a landfill, they pollute the soil. Not only that, once they're gone, mining is increased to dig up more of them, which is also bad for the environment.
Well, I'll definitely recycle my phone.
Great. Now let's look at these phone options.
You now have 2 minutes before you hear the recording for a second and final time.
Okay, who is my next customer?
Oh, that's me. I'm looking for a phone.
What are you in the market for? We mainly carry refurbished goods, but we also have new devices.
Well, before buying my current phone, I read that refurbished phones were as good as new ones, but I'm not sure I agree now.
In my opinion, they're often as good as new. Of course, other factors can also affect the quality, like whether it's certified or how it's been maintained. However, refurbished phones are a lot less expensive than a new device.
Well, I bought this phone refurbished to save money, as you said. But now I plan to buy a new phone because I think it will last longer.
That's not been my experience, but new phones have other advantages. However, if you are buying a new phone, we'd like to encourage you to recycle your old phone because technology products create e-waste.
E-waste? What's that?
Electronic waste. It's now one of the most talked about environmental issues worldwide. Any discarded electrical item can be considered e-waste. But here, we focus on technology and devices.
So, do you recycle devices here?
Not here at the shop. We lack the equipment. But we do collect devices for recycling, for a small fee. It's not cheap to recycle devices, so we cover our costs as we all feel it's essential to protect the environment.
That's okay. It's important that we all do our part.
Great. Let's look at some phones over here then.
You know, I've never really thought about e-waste before.
Believe it or not, there are more mobile phones than people on the planet.
Really?
Look at this diagram on the wall. This is the waste hierarchy, which ranks the preferred order for 5 actions to manage waste, including e-waste. At the top, the most environmentally friendly option is prevention. This means that there's less creation of waste. If people use items longer, for example, fewer phones would need to be manufactured. Reduction is the next best option, followed by recycling. Then, recovery of waste is the fourth stage before disposal, which means that items end up in a landfill. That's the worst option for the environment.
So recycling is important then?
Yes. Unfortunately, only 15 to 20% of e-waste is recycled. And tech products are made with precious metals and minerals. When these end up in a landfill, they pollute the soil. Not only that, once they're gone, mining is increased to dig up more of them, which is also bad for the environment.
Well, I'll definitely recycle my phone.
Great. Now let's look at these phone options.
You now have 2 minutes, 30 seconds to finish answering the questions. Text B. You now have 4 minutes to read the questions.
You are going to hear a presentation for Career Day about becoming a pilot.
Hi everyone, it's great to be here at your school for Career Day. As your teacher stated, I'm a pilot, and I've been flying for an international airline for 5 years. However, I started out 15 years ago for a domestic airline after a lot of training. So let's begin today's talk with what typically happens. I usually work 4 to 5 consecutive days before having 2 days off. But during peak times like summer or holidays, it's only compulsory to have 1 day free from work in 7 for safety. I work from New York City, so I might fly to London the first day and then on to Singapore or Tokyo the next. Pilots bid for different flight routes each month, so it rarely becomes routine. It all sounds exciting, doesn't it? If it's an international flight, which generally has a longer layover, the airline always puts me up in a well-appointed hotel. On one recent trip, I actually had 3 days in Italy, which was nearly as good as a vacation. However, it's not always like that. After an international flight, it's only obligatory to have 14 hours to rest, so it's only a few times a month that I get to spend 24 hours in a city. I exploit my opportunities for travel, though. I make a point of visiting at least one museum or historical spot on every trip, and I try local food, although many of my colleagues are tired of tourism. I suppose I do have to contend with jet lag. Many pilots grow accustomed to flying back and forth across various time zones, but I need to uphold a routine for sufficient sleep. Some of our airplanes hold 300 passengers, which is a great deal of responsibility, so it's imperative to feel my best. So let me share a slide with you demonstrating the primary requirements to become a pilot. The training and certification vary based on a pilot's country of residence, but in general, pilots need to undergo a considerable training regimen before they can fly for a living. Attending flight school for a private pilot license is one way to get training. But did you know that most pilots start out training in the military? Now, a private pilot license allows you to fly, but not for employment. For that, you need a commercial pilot license. This means in addition to knowing how to fly and building up flight hours in the military or as a private pilot, you need to undergo a rigorous medical exam and, of course, demonstrate you have the requisite knowledge to be a commercial pilot. Once hired, pilots start on smaller planes before moving to larger planes for overseas work. But that's not all. Pilots need to be natural leaders with strong reasoning skills and ability with numbers. Of course, being proficient with computers is required, but because there's such an essential focus on keeping everyone safe, it's also necessary to remain patient and composed in stressful situations. And finally, the ability to pay attention to detail is really imperative. As a pilot, you often have to record a lot of data, and it must be accurate. Most importantly, safety is always paramount. So if that sounds interesting, I'm happy to stay after class and answer questions.
You now have 2 minutes before you hear the recording for a second and final time.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here at your school for Career Day. As your teacher stated, I'm a pilot, and I've been flying for an international airline for 5 years. However, I started out 15 years ago for a domestic airline after a lot of training. So let's begin today's talk with what typically happens. I usually work 4 to 5 consecutive days before having 2 days off. But during peak times like summer or holidays, it's only compulsory to have 1 day free from work in 7 for safety. I work from New York City, so I might fly to London the first day and then on to Singapore or Tokyo the next. Pilots bid for different flight routes each month, so it rarely becomes routine. It all sounds exciting, doesn't it? If it's an international flight, which generally has a longer layover, the airline always puts me up in a well-appointed hotel. On one recent trip, I actually had 3 days in Italy, which was nearly as good as a vacation. However, it's not always like that. After an international flight, it's only obligatory to have 14 hours to rest, so it's only a few times a month that I get to spend 24 hours in a city. I exploit my opportunities for travel, though. I make a point of visiting at least one museum or historical spot on every trip, and I try local food, although many of my colleagues are tired of tourism. I suppose I do have to contend with jet lag. Many pilots grow accustomed to flying back and forth across various time zones, but I need to uphold a routine for sufficient sleep. Some of our airplanes hold 300 passengers, which is a great deal of responsibility, so it's imperative to feel my best. So let me share a slide with you demonstrating the primary requirements to become a pilot. The training and certification vary based on a pilot's country of residence. But in general, pilots need to undergo a considerable training regimen before they can fly for a living. Attending flight school for a private pilot license is one way to get training. But did you know that most pilots start out training in the military? Now, a private pilot license allows you to fly, but not for employment. For that, you need a commercial pilot license. This means in addition to knowing how to fly and building up flight hours in the military or as a private pilot, you need to undergo a rigorous medical exam and, of course, demonstrate you have the requisite knowledge to be a commercial pilot. Once hired, pilots start on smaller planes before moving to larger planes for overseas work. But that's not all. Pilots need to be natural leaders with strong reasoning skills and ability with numbers. Of course, being proficient with computers is required, but because there's such an essential focus on keeping everyone safe, it's also necessary to remain patient and composed in stressful situations. And finally, the ability to pay attention to detail is really imperative. As a pilot, you often have to record a lot of data, and it must be accurate. Most importantly, safety is always paramount. So if that sounds interesting, I'm happy to stay after class and answer questions.
You now have 2 minutes 30 seconds to finish answering the questions.
Text C. You now have 4 minutes to read the questions.
You are going to hear a radio program interview with Professor Brown about extreme sports.
Welcome to the program, Professor Brown. I've read that adrenaline is the key to the exponential growth of extreme sports. Is that true?
People often think extreme sports is about the adrenaline rush, but there are actually several types of motivation for engaging in these sports. Let's start with adrenaline, though. Adrenaline is a hormone that enables survival mechanisms to be activated in the body when someone is faced with danger or stress, thus ultimately protecting us.
Why would someone intentionally seek out that fight or flight response you mentioned if it's meant to protect us from harm?
Well, adrenaline increases the heart rate, causing oxygen to circulate through the body more rapidly. This in turn makes us more responsive to sensations. Dopamine is also released in the brain during extreme sports. This powerful chemical is closely linked to feelings of pleasure and reward. The body can grow accustomed to higher levels of these chemicals, though, so people can push themselves to ever riskier behavior. This behavior, in fact, is one of the potentially negative effects of participating in extreme sports.
Along with the inherent risk of injury, I suppose. You mentioned other motivating factors, though. What are those?
Studies show that motivation varies based on how long someone has participated in extreme sports. Factors like excitement, new experiences, and meeting people are most important in the early stages. However, skills development becomes a motivator at the middle stage. Athletes can also be driven by desire for prestige at this level. While at a high level, motivation becomes more internal and includes self-awareness and the need to feel in control.
Sorry to interrupt, Professor. It's time for a commercial break. Welcome back. Let's return to that last point you were making, Professor, about the need to feel in control. Isn't that ironic to want to feel in control in extreme sports?
Well, as athletes become more experienced, part of the challenge is to master uncertain situations. However, friendship remains an important driving force, regardless of experience. There's an immense amount of trust needed due to the inherent danger of these sports. That creates strong bonds.
Wow, there's a lot of intrinsic motivation, isn't there? I never realized the rationale behind taking part in extreme sports was so sophisticated.
Yes. However, another impetus for extreme sports could be considered more external. Athletes delight in sharing videos of themselves engaging in extreme sports across various online platforms. The purpose of these is to entertain and inform others. But on rare occasions, they might attract possible sponsors. Extreme sports is a growing business, and companies want to get in on the action. In the future, I anticipate people might also be interested in coaching others as a career.
I've watched some of those videos. They're incredible. I watched a few base jumpers, in fact, in preparation for this interview.
Yes, that's actually one of the fastest growing extreme sports now, followed by surfing. The latter is one of the extreme sports that debuted in the 2021 Olympics, as did skateboarding. Now, some people disagree with the inclusion of these sports as they consider traditional sports to be more representative of skill and athleticism. They believe the Olympic Committee is trying to attract younger viewers, but I think it's fair to say that these are sports that require great skill and precision and should be included.
Thank you for your insights today, Professor. We'll be back next week with another fascinating topic.
You now have 2 minutes before you hear the recording for a second and final time.
Welcome to the program, Professor Brown. I've read that adrenaline is the key to the exponential growth of extreme sports. Is that true?
People often think extreme sports is about the adrenaline rush, but there are actually several types of motivation for engaging in these sports. Let's start with adrenaline, though. Adrenaline is a hormone that enables survival mechanisms to be activated in the body when someone is faced with danger or stress, thus ultimately protecting us.
Why would someone intentionally seek out that fight or flight response you mentioned if it's meant to protect us from harm?
Well, adrenaline increases the heart rate, causing oxygen to circulate through the body more rapidly. This in turn makes us more responsive to sensations. Dopamine is also released in the brain during extreme sports. This powerful chemical is closely linked to feelings of pleasure and reward. The body can grow accustomed to higher levels of these chemicals, though, so people can push themselves to ever riskier behavior. This behavior, in fact, is one of the potentially negative effects of participating in extreme sports.
Along with the inherent risk of injury, I suppose. You mentioned other motivating factors, though. What are those?
Studies show that motivation varies based on how long someone has participated in extreme sports. Factors like excitement, new experiences, and meeting people are most important in the early stages. However, skills development becomes a motivator at the middle stage. Athletes can also be driven by desire for prestige at this level. While at a high level, motivation becomes more internal and includes self-awareness and the need to feel in control.
Sorry to interrupt, Professor. It's time for a commercial break. Welcome back. Let's return to that last point you were making, Professor, about the need to feel in control. Isn't that ironic to want to feel in control in extreme sports?
Well, as athletes become more experienced, part of the challenge is to master uncertain situations. However, friendship remains an important driving force, regardless of experience. There's an immense amount of trust needed due to the inherent danger of these sports. That creates strong bonds.
Wow, there's a lot of intrinsic motivation, isn't there? I never realized the rationale behind taking part in extreme sports was so sophisticated.
Yes. However, another impetus for extreme sports could be considered more external. Athletes delight in sharing videos of themselves engaging in extreme sports across various online platforms. The purpose of these is to entertain and inform others. But on rare occasions, they might attract possible sponsors. Extreme sports is a growing business, and companies want to get in on the action. In the future, I anticipate people might also be interested in coaching others as a career.
I've watched some of those videos. They're incredible. I watched a few base jumpers, in fact, in preparation for this interview.
Yes, that's actually one of the fastest growing extreme sports now, followed by surfing. The latter is one of the extreme sports that debuted in the 2021 Olympics, as did skateboarding. Now, some people disagree with the inclusion of these sports as they consider traditional sports to be more representative of skill and athleticism. They believe the Olympic Committee is trying to attract younger viewers, but I think it's fair to say that these are sports that require great skill and precision and should be included.
Thank you for your insights today, Professor. We'll be back next week with another fascinating topic.
You now have the rest of the time to finish answering the questions.